You're listening to Harris Smith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode is about a third-generation duck farm and a remarkable multicultural handshake that rocketed the unusual poultry farm to success. Next up, an intimate tour of Prince Edward County, Bottomless Lake, and all. By the way, if you want to read Harris Smith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. Patty Thompson is one of four sisters who run King Cole Ducks near Stouffville, Ontario. That farm has been running for almost 70 years. It was a bit of an oddball at first. Ducks just weren't as popular as beef and chicken in the 50s. But a few decades later, a wave of Chinese immigration washed upon Canada's shores, and that, and a handshake, changed the company forever. I talked with Patty about the past and future of ducks in Canada recently. Here's that conversation. Frame up King Cole Ducks. Where are you? How big are you? Tell me a little bit about the farm.
King Cole Ducks is located just outside of Aurora, Ontario. We're just located off the 404, so we have been in and at this location for almost 70 years through three generations and actually now heading into our fourth generation of family.
Tell me about the early days of duck farming. Like, what was that? That was your grandfather, and who else were involved?
My grandfather and my dad actually started the business back in 1951, and they moved up from southwestern Ontario into the Aurora area and just had a few animals. So they had a few chickens, a few ducks, and a few other critters that they were raising in the little town of Aurora. My grandparents would go down to the North York Farmers Market and basically peddle their wares every weekend. And what was interesting about that is everybody else had chickens and no one had ducks. So I always say, you know, it didn't take them an MBA to figure out that ducks it was, and that was really their unique or point of difference from all the other stalls at the marketplace. So the strain of duck that we raise is called a white Pekin duck. So that's a domestic duck. A lot of people expect that it's going to be like a wild duck. So the difference is it does not fly. It is raised as a meat bird, and its origins actually came from China back 3,000 years ago. So very specifically, this duck was raised for meat consumption and egg consumption, and in our case, we also use it for feathers.
So how is that different, and how is it different for your father and grandfather from raising chickens? I mean, they're both poultry of sorts. They're both domesticated. How are they different in terms of raising them?
I think the difference in raising ducks versus other poultry is they really are a different breed, a different critter. They take far more hands-on work than what chicken production does. For example, you can put chickens, baby chickens, in a barn and basically leave them for the next 6 weeks. Ducks require hands-on every single day bedding. They're typically by nature or DNA as a waterfowl, so they like to play with water. The pens need to be bedded down all the time. Our growth as a company, I guess, came from my grandfather and my dad learning how to raise ducks, and they weren't easy. So it meant that a lot of people just stayed out of it. They were just too darn hard to handle and to raise and to keep healthy through throughout their production planning.
So why not ducks? I mean, it was popular. Ducks have always been popular in Europe. So why wasn't duck farming popular then in Ontario or in Canada, I guess?
So it's a great question of why wasn't duck popular. And I'll say that that has actually been a continued question for all of us over the decades as we've worked really hard to get folks to look at duck as an alternative protein. And I can't answer, you know, for sure back in the 50s of why people weren't, but it was still, and maybe still is, really the main proteins of chicken and beef were what people turned to.
Given that ducks weren't that popular back then, how did your father and grandfather actually grow a business for a protein source that wasn't very popular?
You know, I think it was really at that time was the combination of proteins that they had, because they still had the other proteins such as chicken that they peddled in the local farmers market. So it was a really small business. They had eggs. They had everything they could have to be able to survive. Literally, the change in our business came when we started to see a change in immigration, and the folks who were coming from, specifically from Hong Kong region, were people who where duck was a staple in their diet. So the ducks that we had started to sell quickly into that community.
So I want to get a sense of how you forged that relationship with the new immigrants coming from Hong Kong. Here were a couple of farmers from Ontario. Now there's these new immigrants. So how did that relationship get created?
What I think is really amazing is my dad was a very young guy, and he was a farmer, but he was a businessman, and he recognized that we needed to do something different than everybody else was doing. And he arranged and met with a family called the Lum family, who were new immigrants, and just negotiated a deal on just a handshake, the most wonderful deal to say, let's work together. We can do make the duck. You can do the distribution. Let's make this work. And it was, for the last 50 years now, has been the most amazing agreement.
So when you say distribution, tell me a bit more about what the Lum family distributed, how they distributed, where did they distribute it to?
So the Lum family very specifically was meeting the needs of their fellow Chinese community, I'll call it. Duck was a staple in the Chinese diet back in Hong Kong, and we had duck, so we needed to find a way to connect up. Obviously, back then there was a language barrier, so it was an opportunity for us to do what we did really well and work with a family who could communicate well and serve their community in the best way possible. So every day they would take orders from all these little barbecue shops and chefs and add them all up, and it could be two ducks, it might have been 22 ducks. Whatever the order was, we would produce exactly what was needed. So the chefs were getting perfectly fresh ducks same day, just the same as they did back home in Hong Kong.
Primarily Toronto?
Yes, this is primarily Toronto area, and very specifically fresh head and feet on ducks for the Asian barbecue market.
So it's really cool. So when we see ducks hanging in the shop windows of Chinese restaurants in Toronto, those ducks are and have been for like 50 years coming from your farm. Is that right?
They have, and it really truly is a day in and day out ordering basis, so that the chefs are always getting the freshest. And I can tell you that as a community, the chefs are very, very picky. They want a perfect duck. There cannot be any breaks in the skin. They use the duck as almost a vessel to hold this wonderful marinade that's part of the whole barbecue process. So you have to be really good at what we do, and they are awesome at what they do.
So really, that's been, it sounds like that's been the staple of your business for years and years, is that particular market.
The barbecue duck business and that market has been, without a doubt, our bread and butter. It's been something that we could count on day in and day out throughout the weeks, throughout the years, throughout the months of the last 50 years. So it's really quite something to have that kind of relationship and to see the business continue to grow as the community grew.
So you talked about it being your father and grandfather and three generations on your side. What's happening on the distribution side? Are you still working with that family, and are you hanging out with the kids from that family?
It's a great question. Their business has continued on to their next generation. They just have a single son now, but he's continued the business and continued to grow the business in the fresh world. I think when you ask about how the business scaled beyond that, is that was such a steady business for us. I think that we became somewhat complacent because we had a steady business within the Asian community. And what happened was, back in the early 2000s when SARS hit, we were devastated. Right instantly, overnight, our business was turned off. We had to stop everything, try to figure out where else could our product go. And we recognized it was a really big wake-up call to us that as a company, if we wanted to be healthy and to grow, that we needed to look at more diversity. By that, I mean a more diverse markets and more diverse products.
So tell me a bit about that, because by that time, too, immigration changed dramatically. There were a lot of other nationalities coming, a lot of other nationalities that used duck in different ways from the Hong Kong community, from the Chinese community. So how did you go about sort of reinventing what your father and grandfather did with the Hong Kong community with other groups that used duck?
I think that one of the biggest things that we did as a company, and I'll say this is kind of the evolution of the new generation or the next generation coming in is we looked at where else could we sell our products, and certainly looking at traditional Western style restaurants. And I would say that the benefit of duck is that, first of all, it's different, but not weird different. It has some cachet to it. We started to see that with the influx of other nationalities as well into specifically the GTA, but really right across Canada, that there were opportunities where duck, an enjoyable meal from a different ethnic background. So how else could we fit into this puzzle piece? And so we began looking at how we could work with chefs to create new menu ideas and new kind of twists on the traditional.
So tell me a little bit about that. What other cuisines were you sort of really plugging into and tapping into in terms of recipes and working with chefs?
So other cuisines that we were looking at is basically we went to high-end, I'm going to say fine dining restaurants, and certainly the duck is well-known in Europe. And so a lot of chefs who have had professional or classic training, classic French training, they knew duck. They knew duck well. They just weren't sure whether their customers would enjoy it. So it was a continued push to say not only do we have whole ducks available, but we started to do cut-up programs so that people could buy just the beautiful duck breast. So it filtered its way into those kinds of high-end hotels, tourist areas where people were going for the best of the best. The evolution of our product now over the last, I'm going to say, 5 to 8 years has been taking duck from that high-end restaurant into, I'm going to call it more fun food, into restaurants where it would be more approachable. So it could be things like today we do crispy duck wings that are served in pubs and fun, trendy, kind of funky restaurants. So the evolution of our product has really grown with our love for food right across our country and beyond.
And what are you seeing in terms of people actually using duck at home? Because I assumed that back then when the company started, there wasn't a lot of market for people just cooking it at home. But I get the sense now, you know, when I look at Food and Drink magazine and places like that, that duck is starting to show up in recipes at home, right?
I think that we're seeing that, but I'm really going to be honest with you. I think we've got a long way to go. I believe that if you question a lot of people, they'll say, oh, I'll have it in a restaurant. I'll enjoy it in a restaurant, but cooking at home still is kind of not top of mind. So I think as a company and as an opportunity for us, we have sitting here to say, hey, here's some great ways to prepare duck. One of the things that we did about 8 years ago was we added a development kitchen and a cook plant to our operation, which is completely vertically integrated. So that means from the egg right through to the finished product. And by doing that, it allowed us to take duck from kind of a how do I cook it, what should I do, to a basically heat and serve. You could, a confit duck legs is a perfect example of that, where the duck leg is cooked in its own fat. It has some herbs de Provence, and consumer can take it and just pop it in the oven and in 10 minutes have a beautiful duck dinner.
I think a lot of people are nervous about cooking duck because they're worried about it being a very fatty kind of poultry. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because my understanding is that the fat in duck is different from the fat in chicken, right?
I would say that that's a really common complaint. Not so much a complaint, but a comment. If you ask people, would you like duck? And oftentimes they'll say, oh, I tried it once and it was super fatty. I think fat was definitely the F word a few years ago, but today people recognize that fat can be good for us, it's healthy for us, and it makes things awfully tasty. So a duck is actually, the meat on a duck is very, very lean. The fat is directly under the skin, and it's actually really like a little life jacket. That's what makes a duck float. When it's cooking, it basically bases itself. So it's really an easy roasting kind of product. What we're trying to see now is to say to folks, you know, you can take just a single duck breast, and you can sear it and just finish it off to a medium rare, and it's like a beautiful steak. And that's where we're seeing a lot of growth in the product.
So where do you see the company going in the next 5 or 10 years? I mean, certainly back when it started, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't international shipping the way there is now. You're shipping internationally now, right? So are you seeing that happening more and more, or what are you thinking about in the next 5 or 10 years?
I think the growth for our company will come from exactly that, from international opportunities. I guess it's really three prongs. So if I look here in our own backyard, there's still so many people who have never ever tried duck. So I think we've got a ton of opportunity there. We see this wonderful mix of all these different kinds of ethnic foods coming in and blending, and duck fits into a lot of categories in that area. And beyond that is our opportunities as a Canadian agriculture company outside of our borders. People in other countries look to us for top quality, really good food. And that's something that we can do very well. So we now sell into the Middle East. We sell to Japan, Tahiti, into South America, a number of places. And, of course, to our friends to the south, a significant part of our production goes into the U.S. So there's lots of opportunities to grow outside of our country as well.
So how do you compete? To come back to Hong Kong, China, how do you compete with China? Because I'm sure there's a strong duck market in China itself now, right?
So that's a great question. So when we look at where we should go with our products, China is not would not be top of the list because, quite frankly, there's a ton of duck already growing there. However, with that said, I'm just sending some product into Hong Kong because, again, because Canadian products are looked at as super healthy and really good quality, there is a upper tier of the market that's looking for that product. So I think there is some opportunity there. We've seen demands in other markets, for example, the Philippines, places where you wouldn't maybe even think about that duck would end up going. But our world is a small place now. Changes in things, for example, avian influenza had a huge impact on poultry sales all over the world. So many countries want second sources from countries much further away from their market where they are right now. So I think there's some opportunities to be even the second supply in some of those large volume markets.
Now, your grandfather passed away back in 2016. I think he was like 101 years old. If he was alive now, what do you think he would make of what's become of what used to be his small business?
I'd like to think that if he were here, actually, I know exactly what he'd be doing. He'd be walking into my office and saying, "So, Patty, how are sales today?" He was truly somebody who was always interested in what was happening, and he would stop anywhere and everywhere to learn about things. So I think that watching where we have gone and how we've grown the business, he would be extremely intrigued and always have an idea of how we could take another step forward. That was his DNA for sure, and it would still be the same thing. Right up until the day he was honestly 101, that would be his question. So how are things today? He was fit, he was healthy, and he lived a great life.
I wanted to end up by just asking, I think there's four of you that are basically running a company, four women that are part of the family. Is that right?
I neglected to tell you that my grandmother was a very important part of the trio that started this. So when I said my grandfather, my dad, and my grandmother, and she was the businesswoman. She was very much the person that drove so much for the business and for the family. And it is interesting that now that there's my three sisters and I are responsible for operating this business. We each wear a different hat, but we all come together to brainstorm, to set strategy, and to work on what we think is going to be the next best move for King Cole Ducks.
So, I talked to folks that run the Women in Agriculture Conference, and there was a sense from that conference that things are changing for women in agriculture, but there are still barriers that need to be overcome. Has that been an issue for you, having a female-run company in the ag business?
In our case, I'm going to say I don't think that it has been a barrier, and probably because, yes, agriculture typically was a male-dominated, and so was a lot of the kinds of businesses that we sell into. So we just grew up in that environment with encouragement from my dad that no holds barred. You just go forward and set a plan and go after that plan. So I would tell you that I think that we have been very fortunate that we've had a lot of great people to work with, male and female, to help our business grow. Having a unique product certainly opens a lot of doors, but it's been opened with welcome arms.
That's great to hear, and good luck with moving into new markets in the future, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us about the history of the business and what's happening today.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Take care.
That was Patty Thompson, who, with her sisters, are raising a fourth generation of duck farmers, and, well, ducks too. Philip Norton is an avid photographer and a lover of Prince Edward County. He leads van tours around the kind of an island that juts out into the northeastern part of Lake Ontario near Belleville. I caught up with Philip between van trips and learned about the alcohol-soaked past of that landscape and the wine and locals that set it apart. Here's our chat. First of all, before we get into the nitty-gritty of Prince Edward County, can you position it for folks who might not be from Ontario, might not know where Prince Edward County is? So paint a little picture for
us. Well, I've looked at some satellite images, and we stick right out into Lake Ontario. It's a peninsula, actually. We call it an island because it's cut off by the Murray Canal. But it's a peninsula sticking out on the north shore of Lake Ontario, and we're sort of midway between, say, Cornwall and Toronto, just south of the Highway 401, about 20 minutes drive.
Cool. And it's sort of historically, I think it's sort of made its fortune off of booze one way or another, right? Can you talk a bit about that?
That's true. It's what I tell my guests on my guided tours. I guess you could say it goes back to the barley days, which is when Prince Edward County grew a great malting barley, which I believe was exported mostly to the New York area where the breweries were. And it was quite made a lot of fortunes for not only the growers, but the shippers across the lake. Then we go, I guess, ahead to the Prohibition days when the U.S. Didn't have alcohol, and some of our rum runners were doing the same shipping of our whiskey across the lake. Both those cases, alcohol was involved in economic boom. Then we arrive in the 2000s, and wineries have taken hold here. And I think we have up to almost 50 wineries within the past 20 years. Most of them have arrived. And also now craft breweries are sprouting up, as well as we have one distillery and maybe two or three cider houses. So really, yeah, this is a... We don't want prohibition here.
So let's talk a little bit about the wineries, because you said that Prince Edward County sort of sticks out into Lake Ontario. So that really changes the nature of the grape, I would think, that grows there and the kind of wines that are produced. Can you talk a little bit about how Prince Edward County differs from, say, the Niagara region in terms of wine production?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. The first one to plant vines here was a German man, Ed Neusser, and he knew the effect of the lake in stabilizing the microclimate. So, for those of your listeners who don't understand, the lake ice, holds the cold well into spring. Even now, we have in May, we have very cool temperatures, so it prevents the grapes from flowering too early that they might get a frost. So then in the end of the season, the lake is holding the summer heat, and it extends the growing season well into September, even into October. And, it gives the ample time for the grapes to mature. Now you have Niagara, which is just that much further south and maybe not as influenced by the west winds aren't right over a lake so much. And say their Pinot Noirs are going to be more the dark side and more of a southern varieties are being grown, whereas we touch on a few unusual northern varieties. And here's one thing that I just learned is we can't really do ice wine like they can in Niagara, because we have to bury our vines through the winter so they don't have the death of the vines. So the ice wine depends on leaving the grapes on the vine for a long into the frozen, winter, and picking them in the snow, actually. But we're already burying the vines by that time, whereas in Niagara, they can leave them exposed.
So what, apart from having to bury the vines, what else is different about Prince Edward County? When you take folks on tours, what are you seeing? What are they experiencing that would be different than other parts of Ontario?
So I moved here in 2007, and at that time, it wasn't really the big tourism hotspot that it has become in the last decade. And there's still, ample remnants of the authentic way of life. So on my tours, I like to show them the authenticity and the old timers and the county people and the farms that are still, just family owned and small scale. That's what our wineries look like here too. They're all pretty much small scale, family owned. And, when the visitors come, sometimes it's really crowded with tour buses and such, but you still can spread out. There's lots of room, and they have outdoor tasting. And whereas what I've experienced just passing through Niagara, you have the big, the giant Wayne Gretzky, really popular wineries. In fact, driving down the QEW, I thought it was an industrial park, but it turned out it was wineries. You know, so they've got this, this different kind of image. You know, I know that Niagara has some of the small wineries too, and maybe will become more and more popular because the tourists like to take their own little tours on the back roads and discover a new, you know, an old farm that's now growing, you know, grapes and wine. That's the appeal here, I think. And also with the Drake Devonshire Inn, which is a rural offshoot of the Drake Hotel downtown Toronto, Queen Street. This has given, you know, real prominence to the sort of what they call hipster or the, you know, the young professionals who want to get this experiential tourism, and they're willing to spend their money more on fun experiences and, you know, doing selfies in special places rather than material goods.
So what would you say, apart from that hotel, what's pick one place that you think if you come to Prince Edward County, the one place you got to go is what?
That's a good one. You know, here's an experience I had. I had a group of, I guess they were called the CEO Club of Ottawa, and they were photographers and, you know, just out for a good time. And I said, you know, for our half-day tour, I think we should skip Lake on the Mountain and we can do a lot of other things. He said, oh, no, we have to go to Lake on the Mountain. They've all heard about this bottomless lake and it's 200 meters above the bay. And, you know, so since then, I've never omitted Lake on the Mountain from my tours. It's just, it is a gem. And it's right beside it, there's Lake of the Mountain Inn, and there's a brasserie or a patio sticking right out over the edge where you look out over the Bay of Quinte and the Picton Bay, and it's a remarkable place. So I'd say everybody go to the Lake on the Mountain Provincial Park. There's a parking lot, and then you can walk across the road there to see this mysterious lake that, you know, you wonder, how is it filling up? Where's the water coming from? It's at the top of the mountain.
Well, thanks for tipping us off about that gem and the gem in general that it sounds like Prince Edward County is for. Thanks a lot, and enjoy your tours.
Okay, Wayne, thanks for having me.
That was Philip Norton firing up the van in Prince Edward County. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple, iTunes, or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.